The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Thursdays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Danny Schechter, your News Dissector, every week at this time, not always at this time, Lewis will tell you in a minute, on PRN, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. This is a program based and an extension of the blog I write on MediaChannel.org. It's about what's in the news, what's not in the news, what should be in the news, and the like. And today we have a very interesting program with Ted Rall, a Pulitzer Prize-winning nominated cartoonist who's just come back from Afghanistan and will tell us all about it in a few minutes. First, just a few announcements. First, this program is moving its time period to Fridays at 1 o'clock. That is from Thursdays at 10 to Fridays at 1 following Gary Null's program. Hopefully, there'll be a bigger time, better time period for us. Apparently, people who call in tend to wake up a little late, and so we should be in a better position at 1 o'clock on Fridays. So that's starting next week, October 1, here on PRN. If you want to join our conversation, you can do so with a toll-free call to 888-874-4888. So that's that news. Tonight, I'm going to be showing my film, Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, in Huntington, Long Island, at the Cinema Arts Center, which is at 423 Park Avenue. It's 100 yards south of Route 25A and Main Street. And that's happening tonight at 7:30. I'll be speaking. We'll be showing the film, and it should be an interesting interaction with folks there. On Monday night, I did a launch of my new book, The Crime of Our Time, at the Half King Bar in Chelsea, which is known as a place for literary readings and the like. And I was very interested that a member of the Tea Party came. And the two of us went at it, and other people went at it with her. She gave no ground. Others gave no ground. It was an amazing conversation. Actually, it's on the air because I was also recording it for Between the Lines Radio, which is comes out of Bridgeport, Connecticut, Scott Harris and his team. And I did so on my iPhone. So you actually have reactions from people in the audience, the woman from the Tea Party, my speech, and all of that on this one radio show. So that was an interesting, spontaneous encounter, and I want to share it with you. I posted a new commentary on MediaChannel.org this morning, and you can find the URL for the radio show there if you do want to listen to it. So all of that out of the way right now, we're going to be moving on to talking about Afghanistan, and at the end of the program, about the economy with Aaron Crown and Eddie Morales. Eddie works with the Foreclosure Defense Group on Long Island, working with people who are trying to hold on to their homes and fighting for their rights in the foreclosure fights that are going on all over America. So you'll hear all of that this morning on News Dissector Radio. Stay with us, won't you?
To chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also B of A. American Express and Visa.
That's the theme song for my film, In Debt We Trust, that came out in 2006, Warning of the Financial Crisis. Joining us now as well, Sherry Welsh from Atlanta, Georgia, the dissectress who works with me on this radio show and on the blog, which has a new look, a great new look, thanks to work by Franz Hartle and Sherry. And I'd love you to check it out and give me some feedback on it. So I'd like to introduce, welcome to the program, Ted Rall. Ted is a very unique force in our popular culture. He's a cartoonist of distinction. He was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. But beyond that, he's won my Pulitzer Prize because he's a on-point, on-target cartoonist and blogger and writer. And his work is extremely interesting at Rawl.com, the Rawl blog. You can check it out, and he reports on his recent trip to Afghanistan. So good morning, Ted. Welcome to the program. Welcome back to the U.S. of A. In our part of the war on terror that you can tell us about, or the lack of a war on terror. How did you get to go to Afghanistan this time? So this was your second trip, and give us some of the highlights of what you saw there.
Well, good morning, Danny. I just want to say it's a huge honor to be on your show. I'm a big fan of your writing and your work in general, and what you're doing to critique media. I just loved your last book too. Just awesome. I had the occasion to go to Afghanistan through a sort of unique set of circumstances. Back in 2001, I had gone for the Village Voice and for KFI Radio in Los Angeles, and I'd also done some syndicated work. It was pretty easy to raise money back then for war correspondency. If anything, the media had trouble finding people who were willing to go, and they were willing to pay handsomely for anyone who was willing to take the chance. Now things have changed, as your listeners know. The media has melted down, and I wouldn't say that they don't have the money for war correspondency. They're just choosing not to spend it. And so I found myself earlier this year wanting to return, but not knowing how to finance it. Most of the magazines that I've worked for in the past have gone out of business. My editors are now trying to make it as my former editors are trying to make it as freelance writers. And so I was kind of desperate. And then I was talking to a friend of mine, a fellow cartoonist named Stephanie McMillan, who does a comic strip called Minimum Security. And she had raised some money for a new book through a website called Kickstarter.com. And it's kind of an interesting model. You basically say, in my case, I said, I want $25,000. And if I get $25,000 in funding, I will go to Afghanistan and report the truth back, which we're clearly not getting from the mainstream media. Well, 211 people stepped up. I ended up getting $26,000.
Wow.
And they don't get anything much in return. They get some signed. Some people get some signed books. One person who put up a lot gets a dinner with me, but that's about the extent of it. They're not getting royalties.
Are you cooking?
No, I have to take them out to dinner. I think I have to pay for steak.
Well, actually, we used Kickstarter to raise some money for the promotion of Plunder, the Crime of Our Time, a new film. And thinking of trying it again because we did raise some money and it did help us complete the film. So
it's good for people like us who have, who are doing stuff that's outside of the mainstream, and that people we're fulfilling a need, I think. But if you're just sort of doing generic projects, you're probably not going to get the support from people. And also, I think you have to have long-time followers. But anyway, so it worked. I got the money. And then in August, early August, I'm along with two other cartoonists, Stephen Cloud and Matt Bors. We went to Tajikistan and then went to Afghanistan. We were in country for 3 weeks. And then we left through Iran, incidentally becoming the first Americans since the Islamic Revolution to cross the border from Afghanistan to Iran. So that was in the, right during Quds Week, the anniversary of the riots last year. So it was a real interesting
experience. Did you get arrested?
We were arrested in Afghanistan, actually, but not in Iran. In Iran, they were very hospitable, I have to say. It was easier to get around in Iran and to enter Iran than to come in through JFK Airport from a security standpoint. They didn't even make us run our bags through a scanner. They said, "Oh, you're foreigners. We don't do that to foreigners. That's rude." I was like, imagine if our countries had diplomatic relations. So it was pretty amazing and very interesting, but that's sort of a side story. In fact, I'm thinking of doing a little comic book as a side project about the trip to Iran.
But when you disclosed on your form, your immigration form, returning to the land of the free, and acknowledged that you had been to Afghanistan, did you get any special attention?
You know, this is one of those things where it just goes to show. My 75-year-old mother has to take her shoes off at the airport, but I come back. I come back with a beard looking like Osama, from Afghanistan, Iran, and Tajikistan, and not a word, not a question, waved right through, didn't even have to go through customs. The line was long, though.
Well, there you go. Ted, Sherry, why don't you just say a few words, because you were able to get Ted to come on the program, and you're one of his fans as well. So why don't you say a few words about his work that grabs you?
Well, I first started reading Ted on the blog that he writes, and he wrote this wonderful piece about why France couldn't wage a war against the Germans invading, and he did and I wish you would repost that, Ted, and explained that there wasn't enough time between the end of World War I and the beginning of World War II to repopulate cannon fodder. But then Ted did this incredible smackdown with Sean Hannity and gave him not a quarter. So I'm very interested in what you discovered, what's really going on in Afghanistan, Ted, rather than the, rah, rah, rah story we get.
Well, I feel like I'm destined to be a contrarian my entire life, and as Danny probably knows, it doesn't pay well. It's much better to be Thomas Friedman and reflect conventional wisdom every step of the way. And this Afghan war is just like that. When I went in 01, bombs were falling. It was the Middle Ages. It was complete and utter chaos, and I came back horrified and screaming at the top of my lungs that the United States should just get the hell out. And that's been my take ever since. But this time I haven't changed my view on the war, but certainly it's different than what people think. People think that there's no infrastructure and that the U.S. hasn't done anything because the U.S. didn't do anything from 2001 till 2005, and then the media basically stopped covering Afghanistan after 2005. But the truth is that there is actually quite a bit of new infrastructure that exists now that's kind of amazing if you travel there. I mean, we traveled over land across roads that would have been beautiful roads here in the U.S. And, we're talking about a country that didn't have any paved roads whatsoever before 9/11. So, I had allocated, for instance, 4 days to get from the Tajik border to Talakan in northern Afghanistan. We did it in 8 hours, at about 100 miles an hour. The infrastructure situation has improved dramatically. There's better cell phone coverage than there is on Long Island. There's places where there's Wi-Fi. It's kind of incredible. Okay, that stuff, and it's weird that the U.S. isn't really bragging about that, because they should be proud. I mean, it's a big difference, and it really helps the Afghan people. Now, from a security standpoint, things are not worse, but they're pretty much as bad as they were in 01. What's happened is, however, that the threat's coming from a different source. The U.S. is not fighting a war that is actually relevant to the lives of the Afghan people. Imagine if it were happening here that we were occupied by a foreign power, and the foreign power was spending all of its time high up in the Rocky Mountains and the high Sierras, chasing ghosts and phantoms, but not actually providing any security against rampant thuggery and gangsters who were setting up checkpoints and kidnapping, robbing, raping, and killing people at will without anyone stopping them. And that's the situation that you have in Afghanistan. The entire war is being fought in the far eastern mountains, very remote part of the country. But you can be in Afghanistan for 3 weeks, as we were, and never see a U.S. soldier walking around. We saw troop transports 3 times, and each time they were zooming by, screaming at people to get out of the way or that they would be shot, pointing their guns at them. And that's the presence. That's the entire presence. They stay in their the U.S. and NATO forces stay hidden in their cantonments like scared little bunny rabbits, and so do the journalists, because all the journalists are embedded. We were arrested 3 times by Afghan police because we were suspected of being Pakistanis or Taliban suicide bombers because we dressed like locals. We had long beards. And, in fact, we sort of out-Afghans the Afghans. We kind of had to get our beards trimmed to a Northern Afghan men really kind of have short, trimmed beards, and that's what we had to do. But the thing is that they just couldn't believe it. When people would talk to us, they'd say, "You're not real journalists." And they'd say, "Real journalists are embedded with the troops. Real journalists don't talk to Afghans. We've been here the U.S. has been here 9 years. We've never met an American citizen." And I was just dumbfounded. I mean, I couldn't believe that you could occupy a country with 140,000 troops, probably about another 140,000 contractors, plus about 100,000 NGO workers, and have Afghans who run stores in Kabul have never met an American. But once you're there, you see it. There's no presence on the ground. So what happens is that the Taliban and their new partners, these gangsters who are running bike gangs and call themselves Talibs, but really aren't. They're really like old-fashioned Mujahideen murderers and rapists are, they're running around doing whatever the hell they want, and they're victimizing Afghans. So sort of the net effect is a country that's been effectively completely bifurcated by the Taliban and their gangster allies. So,
and what about the Al-Qaeda presence? Supposedly, that's the reason for our being there, right?
Al-Qaeda probably had, even according, I'm sure you know about this, but the Pentagon assessed that there were like maybe a half dozen Al-Qaeda members.
Really?
Yeah, like this was like 5 years ago. Al-Qaeda is more of an idea than a force. And anyway, it was always based in Pakistan before 9/11, still is. I mean, on 9/11, there were only two Al-Qaeda training camps in Afghanistan, both of which had been closed for 2 years. So there was really no significant Al-Qaeda presence in Afghanistan ever, at least not since
1999. So we're being told that we're fighting a war against an enemy that doesn't exist.
Well, they exist. They're in the wrong country. They're in Pakistan.
Yeah, but also, let's not forget that they're in the so-called tribal areas of Pakistan, which were never really controlled by Pakistan. They were sort of like, the Badlands. I mean,
yeah, that's right.
It didn't seem like the Pakistanis had very much control there either, which is why, of course, it was chosen as an ideal place for an organization or a non-organization or a network like Al-Qaeda. But it seems like, this myth of fighting Al-Qaeda, protecting the American homeland and all of the rest of this,
that's a farce.
Is ridiculous. And yet, it remains used in Congress for, increased appropriations, for the so-called surge, which hasn't been doing much surging of late. It seems as if this is almost like a fantasy war.
It is. I think that's a pretty good way to put it. And what's really astonishing is that it's a war that doesn't even seem to be taking place in most of Afghanistan. Whether you're in the cities or whether you're traveling through the countryside, and we did both, and we were kept, everybody told us we were crazy. Everybody kept saying, you're going to be killed, you can't go outside of the cities, you can't go to this area, you can't go to that area. Well, we went, and
I'm sure your old Village Voice press card was very helpful in getting through those checkpoints, okay? Marauders, Oh, Village Voice, great, welcome.
Our favorite, we love Jules Pfeiffer.
I have a quick question for you.
Sure.
You made an interesting point where people in Afghanistan have rarely encountered a U.S. citizen. Wasn't Bearing Point there because a friend of mine got killed in that suicide bombing, Thor Hesla, he of the Anne of a Thousand Lays, all about Ann Coulter, for Salon Magazine. But anyway, getting back to the point, he got killed in that, but he was working with Bearing Point. Is Bearing Point not there to help build the lives of the Afghans and create some kind of job program for them or give them an industry?
Well, I can't speak specifically to Bearing Point. What I can say is that there's kind of a, once you get there, you realize that the Afghans and most American expats have a very dim view of what we call NGO-istan. There's this huge infrastructure that's self-perpetuating that you see in these countries. The UN with their entire giant fleet of UN aircraft and SUVs and Hummers and it goes down to, you know, as I call them, doctors without borders, but with reservations, because they're booked at 4-star hotels that are, you know, they're paying $400 a night per room with donor money.
The money is then banked at the lovely Kabul bank, and they
right,
get
so
and when they open an account
there.
They get a toaster and they get, you know,
and an AK-47.
Exactly.
Yeah, no, it's actually a complete farce. I mean, the Afghans, I mean, you know, it's hard to know where to start with the ridiculousness. I mean, they have these provincial reconstruction teams that are those are NATO military bases that have been sitting around for 5 years. And when you ask the locals and the people who are part of these efforts what they've accomplished, they're like, "Oh, we have many, many projects." And it's like, "Okay, well, what have you actually done?" "Well, we paved this road." It's like, "Well, I've been on that road. That road is, you know, is 1 kilometer long, and that's great. But it's been 5 years. What have you done with the billions of dollars?" And I think that's what the Afghans are asking. And, you know, I mean, in a sense, they're more sophisticated than Americans are, because they're demanding more accountability, and frankly, they're heavily armed and in a better position to get it.
You have an hysterical blog here about going out in search of the Trans-Afghanistan pipeline. Now, the pipeline was, you know, before 9/11, this was the thing that the Bush administration was working on with UNICAL, I believe,
yep.
To try to put a pipeline through Afghanistan. There were many meetings in the United States and in Pakistan between American officials and the Taliban. It was all very cozy. They were close to making a deal. And
then
9/11 happened, and the U.S. decided that the Taliban was al-Qaeda, which it wasn't. Okay.
No, it wasn't.
And you know, decided to attack them too. So we're in a sense at war with, you know, the wrong enemy. And unfortunately for the United States, for NATO, these people are pretty good fighters, pretty seasoned fighters. It's their country. They know the terrain. And they seem to be, you know, resilient and the resourceful and,
yep.
and successful in terms of the, achieving the goals they want to achieve. I mean, Mullah Omar has just made this rare public statement saying he believes the war is in its final phase.
So does everyone else in Afghanistan.
Well, explain that to us. What do they mean by that?
I mean, everyone in Afghanistan is prepared for the Taliban to take over next year. In a sense, the conservative critique that setting a date for withdrawal would tell the Taliban when they could take over turned out to be 100% correct. However, the fact is that it was always an inevitability that they were going to withdraw, that the U.S. was going to withdraw, that NATO was going to withdraw. So, in a sense, you're telling them what they already know. Mullah Omar is correct. The U.S. is leaving. The Karzai regime is going to collapse like a house of cards. It was hated and reviled the day it took over, because of the way it took over.
And now, according to the Washington Post's all-knowing Mr. Bob Woodward, apparently there's an intelligence report that Karzai has been diagnosed as a manic depressive. Oh, my God.
Well, wouldn't you be depressed if you knew you were going to probably end up decapitated next year?
I think that's what happened to his predecessor, didn't?
Yeah, Najibullah.
Yeah.
I don't think we can even say on the air the details of what happened to him.
But, you know, this Woodward book has now come out, interesting timing, on Obama's wars, and describes this incredible war within, you know, the Pentagon and the White House about what the Afghan policy should be, with everybody sort of at each other's throats, it seems.
But you noticed that immediate withdrawal was never considered. And it was really the only sane policy. But it's never part of the equation with either Obama or Bush. I mean, is there a difference, really?
Well, this is because of the memory, I believe, going back into the 40s, really, you know, the whole who lost China, you know,
right.
Who lost Vietnam, you know, who lost Afghanistan in, you know, a succession of fears on the part of American politicians that they will be held responsible for losing a war, which is a really kick in the American ego, you know.
Right. No, I agree with that. That's totally true. I don't know why Democrats play that game and don't point out that neither China nor Vietnam nor Afghanistan nor Iraq were ever ours to win. They don't belong to us.
And now we're selling arms to Vietnam, believe it or not. We're, you know, cozy to cozy with, you know, the people who still worship Ho Chi Minh. And we do business with the people who worship Mao Zedong in China, as we should. I agree. But, you know, my point here, you know, is that think of the years of the, you know, the vilification of those countries and the demonization of anybody who is advocating any sort of peaceful negotiations or you know, coming to terms, détente, whatever you want to call it, with China or Vietnam. And now, of course, it's kind of acceptable.
Yeah, that's what drives me crazy, is that, you know, you can your crazy fringe viewpoint will become mainstream. And then, you know, Thomas Friedman adopts it. And then there's no apologies forthcoming, you know? I mean, all the people who were called anti-American for opposing the war in Vietnam or Afghanistan or Iraq, you know, they were demonized. And then it's like, well, where's our apology? We were right, you know? And it's that's the way I feel about the Afghanistan thing. I mean, after 9/11, there were very few voices against that war. I mean, for the Democrats, Afghanistan was the good war. And people and liberals gave me an incredibly hard time for being opposed to that war. Now everybody's against it, even Republicans. And
I think it's some 60% plus public opinion opposes the war, opposes Iraq as well.
Yeah, so where's my apology? And can I have my clients back who canceled me back in 2002 because they said I was un-American?
Is that right? Is that what happened?
Oh, yeah, a lot. It happened a lot. I mean, you know, anyone who took a stance back in 01, 02 against, and 03 against Bush and his policies was, thrown out of newspapers and never brought back. I was thrown out of the New York Times. I was thrown out of Washington Post, never to come back.
So much.
So, Ted, what,
I'm sorry.
After being there for 3 weeks, what accomplished, if anything? Are we hated over there? Have we accomplished anything in Afghanistan?
I think the short answer is yes, but it probably doesn't matter. I think the analogy I like to use is kind of like it's like a bad marriage. The abusive husband goes to AA, stops drinking, stops fritting away the paychecks, stops gambling, stops hitting his wife. And his wife recognizes that he's changed, but you know what? She hates him. It's too late. It's over. And that's kind of how it is. I mean, we came in 2001. The truth is we were never going to be accepted because we were an invader. But we could have done a better job at making a good first impression. And you know, the thing that Afghans keep saying is, you keep sending us soldiers. Why don't you send us help? And, you know, the only thing I can answer to them is that it's what we do to everything. You know, we sent troops to Haiti, not help. We sent troops to the South Asian tsunami victims, not help. We sent troops to New Orleans, not help. So the country's become so crazy militarized that we didn't recognize that really Afghanistan, if it was anything, was a nation-building project. If we had come in and said, look, we don't care who runs your country. We're not going to try to depose the Taliban or anyone else. That's up to you. But you guys really need some construction and you need some help. We'd love to help you out. We'll recognize you diplomatically. You guys figure it out. We just want to help you out.
And weren't we warned about this? I'm sorry, I interrupted. Go ahead.
Sorry. No, I said that might have stood the chance.
Warn us about this in 1989?
See, I go back even further. I mean, when the so-called Mujahideen, you know, drove the Soviets out or were fighting the war against the Soviets with CIA help and the Soviets left, you know, the country, you know, we left too. And the country was basically left to the warlords, who proceeded to war with each other, because that's what warlords do, and destroy not only thousands of lives, tens of thousands of lives, but the whole country.
Yep.
And we didn't do anything. So in a sense, we stood by. We got our goal met there. You know, the Soviets left, but, you know, and helped bring down the Soviet Union. Hooray. But, you know, for the people of Afghanistan, it's been one long chain of misery ever since.
Yeah, and we were responsible for that in the late 80s because, after all, they did have a Soviet-backed government that we got rid of, and then we didn't replace it with anything.
Right. So. Listen, I want to come back. I want to talk with you. We're going to take a little short break. I want to come back and talk with you about this Trans-Afghanistan pipeline. We raised it before, but we never really pursued it. And I think your account of your search for it is funny and fascinating. So Ted Rall will be staying with us and talking some more about his recent visit to Afghanistan. I'm so happy he's here. Also, just, you know, tonight, Oliver Stone's, tomorrow, Oliver Stone's Wall Street, you know, Money Never Sleeps opens. And the Village Voice, the paper that Ted Rall used to work for, basically takes it to task for not blaming the people who should be blamed for this crisis. You know, it's if everybody's to blame, then nobody's to blame. We'll talk some more about that as well. Stay with us here on News Dissector Radio on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Your Honor, for many years, I operated a Ponzi scheme through the investment advisory side of my business. I knew what I was doing was wrong, indeed criminal.
The shine on America's shoes got gold.
When Wall Street stepped into the fold,
Congress paid off work.
Stanford, AIG, and Madoff.
Credit swaps, credit stops, empty wallets, empty shops, dead bank walking to AAA. Grandpa loses 401k.
Progressive Radio Network. Information for the independent mind.
Freedom News Hour will bring you up to date on the latest news on the financial meltdown.
Begin restoring local communities. It can happen.
We'll be exploring the issues from a freedom-oriented, small government perspective.
I'm Walt Thiessen.
I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster.
I am Jake Town.
Join us live Thursday evenings at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
This is Glenn Ford. Join me and co-host Nellie Bailey every Monday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time for Black Agenda Radio, an hour of news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. That's Black Agenda Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.
Houston, we have a problem.
Christiane Brown. In today's 24-hour news cycle, most people get about a minute of real truth. Not on the Solution Zone. Every week, I bring in America's best-known activists, bloggers, authors, and politicians to uncover the hidden issues that help separate the truth from the spin.
The Solution Zone with Christiane Brown, every Wednesday at 3 on Progressive Radio Network.
Listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Are we going to fix that technical problem?
ABC,
NBC,
CBS,
CNN,
Fox News,
breaking news,
faking news, the media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
I worked at ABC News, work at CNN.
To see so many colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration.
General, 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 General.
Thank you, sir.
sir.
The Pentagon also controls the timing of bad news, the heavy-handed way of managing the message.
Media war.
Managing the message.
Well, that's the song Media War by Polarity One. Ted, I wanted you to hear that. That's a take on the media coverage of the war and, you know, that I've written about and did the film WMD about. Now, you're in Afghanistan and you decide, hey, I'd like to find that pipeline that was the subject of so much discussion and debate before the war started. So what happens?
Well, I had written, I've been fascinated by the pipeline story. People who are not familiar with it certainly probably heard about it in Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11. And but I had written a book about it in 2003 called Gas War, which essentially puts together all the pulls together all the disparate strings of mainstream media accounts to sort of formulate the most comprehensive history of the pipeline project. It's not a conspiracy theory, despite what certain neocons like Brendan Nyhan have to say. It's still on the drawing table. In fact, Hamid Karzai commented on it 2 weeks ago, and the president of Turkmenistan is arranging a summit meeting, another one, between the presidents of Afghanistan, Turkmenistan, and Pakistan to talk about this. So it's a real story. You know, it's not like a 9/11 truther thing. It's true. It's weird. It's strange but true. So the real question is not whether...
Strange but true.
Exactly. So the question really is, you know, did they start actually building it? Now, there were some mainstream media accounts on Reuters and others that said that, in fact, the ground had been broken north of Herat in northwestern Afghanistan near the border with Turkmenistan, which is logical because at the time this was one of the safer parts of the country, one of the safest, and it's also where the pipeline would need to come. You certainly would start there. Pipelines have to go near some kind of highway so that they can be serviced in the event of a leak. Every major pipeline goes near a major road. So it could only be in one place. It had to be on the highway north of Herat between the border with Turkmenistan. So I kept waiting for some mainstream journalists to go up there and take a look. But no one ever did. And finally I made it, okay, I'm going to make this one of my assignments when I go to Afghanistan. So one morning, I got into a car with a driver and Matt and Steven, and off we headed towards the Turkmen border. And we drove and we drove and we drove across the desert, saw more and more desert. We went through a little town, a district called Kosht, which is a Taliban-controlled area. We zipped through there. The driver was terrified. He was like, you know, wrap your faces, don't let anyone see you, take your sunglasses off, Afghans don't wear sunglasses. And to make a long story short, we made it to the Turkmen border. No pipeline. Clearly no pipeline. Nothing that resembled a pipeline. No construction projects. No refineries. No pipeline. I've seen oil infrastructure before. There was just nothing. Just nothing. So we get to the border, and we're driving around town, and we're stopping people and asking them if they know anything about it. And in fact, we talked to the regional Afghan mayor, and he's the local governor, and he said that, you know, this is, as far as he knew, nothing had been done, but that this is certainly something that they would like to see happen because it would hopefully bring some money into the region. We're driving around town. We finally meet this old guy. And he says, yeah, I know where it is. It's like they did start building it. and so we're like, yes. And so we're like, can you take us to see it? Well, it's not there anymore. It's like, what do you mean it's not there anymore? Well, it's been stolen. The local people stole it. I'm like,
they stole the pipeline?
They stole the Trans-Afghanistan pipeline. And I was like, that is the best story ever. But like, where is it? What do they do with it? Well, they'd used it to build a mosque.
Oh, I hope not at ground zero. No,
okay. I hope they got the oil out before they built it. So I'm starting to really, you know, I have this vision of this grand, the most bizarre cathedral-like mosque, Our Lady of the Trans-Afghanistan Pipeline. and this guy's like, I'll take you to it. So we're very excited. He takes us across town. We walk through some fields. And we go into this like low-slung building, which is maybe got a wall that's maybe 10 feet, 11 feet high. It's just a building. You can't even tell that it's a mosque. I take their word for it that that's their local mosque, but there's nothing to identify it. There's no minarets, nothing. And inside, indeed, there are...
Maybe that's because they thought they were in Switzerland. Couldn't have a minaret. Okay, go ahead.
Is that Switzerland or Denmark? I thought that was Holland.
No, Switzerland.
Oh, yeah? Okay. So, although, if you've been woken up at 5 in the morning by the call to prayer, you can see the advantage of getting rid of the minarets. But anyway, it was...
They described the minarets, by the way, as Islamic missiles.
That's excellent.
Okay.
Yeah, before there were missiles. But anyway, we walk in, we see, and indeed there are pipes holding up the corners and across as serving as rafters of this building. But these pipes, okay, this is just like the scene in Spinal Tap where the little mini Stonehenge comes down from the wall from the ceiling. It's like the pipes are maybe 9 inches in diameter. I mean, an oil pipeline is big. In fact, this particular one would be relatively small, 52 inches, but that's, you know, still a good 2 yards in diameter almost. And we're talking about something big. Now, so these are these old rusty pipes. And I'm like, dude, that's not an oil pipeline. He goes, it is so. I'm like, no, that's like a water pipe or maybe a sewage drain. And he's like, no, this is the oil pipeline from Turkmenistan, like that the people stole and that the Soviets built. I'm like, what do you mean the Soviets built? I'm talking about something that was just started, that they started building 5 years ago, new, big, like made this gesture with my hand, you know, big. he's like, this is it. Like, look harder. This is it. And, you know, it was like you just had to laugh. Because it was such a funny idea. We took some pictures, and then we left, and that was the end of the tale of the Trans-Afghanistan pipeline. I mean, it's not that... The irony is that people might say, well, that proves that the U.S. did not invade Afghanistan to build a pipeline, but it doesn't prove any such thing. No, the U.S. did invade Afghanistan partly to put in a pipeline, at least partly, but it'll never be built.
They never got around to it. They forgot why they were there, right? I mean,
well, it's too dangerous. Well, yeah, no, exactly. They forgot everything about why they were there. They were supposedly there to take on the Taliban. They haven't done that. They were supposedly there to rebuild everything. They haven't done that either.
I think a conclusion, and I don't know if you know David Swanson, but he writes a lot about the anti-war movement and the war, and he's basically, you know, saying my conclusion is that the war, from the U.S. point of view, has been lost. Not just the war is in trouble, but that from a military and political point of view, things have gone so badly that they cannot be turned around, even with more time and resources.
No, I think that's right. I think that if I went in to run the war, it's too late, you know, with unlimited resources. It's too late because the Afghan people are done with us, you know. I mean, what they wanted was blue helmets. They wanted the UN approach. They wanted peacekeepers, people who were going to rebuild the roads, make things safe for them to move around. We didn't do that. We're not interested in that. I mean,
unfortunately, as someone who's just come back from the Congo in this last December and hung out with the UN peacekeepers there, they're having a heck of a job, a heck of a challenge there to try to actually be effective at all. Some have accused the peacekeepers themselves of having engaged in human rights abuses, rape, etc. So, you know, that's not a panacea either, but certainly this isn't, you know, working. And, you know, part of it, I think, is basically the logic of occupation. Occupations of countries don't work in the long run. I mean, they may, you know, impose high costs, they may kill a lot of people, but they don't achieve goals, generally speaking. Certainly not in a place like Afghanistan, where people fought wars for many years, and a country called the Graveyard of Empires managed to resist and repel invasions from, you know, some great powers and with large amounts of money and soldiers and all the rest of that, and basically kick their butts. So, I mean, I think the idea that this can work is not really too effective, you know?
Oh, it's a complete fantasy. I mean, you know, I read something that I was very taken by about 10 years ago. I can't remember where, but it was a reminder that no country has successfully invaded and occupied another since the 19th century. And
well,
I thought that
was... curiously, you know, when you think about our own country, I feel like we're occupying ourselves by this kind of corporate military ethic and influence and institutional framework so that Americans themselves are not really getting much clarity on these issues, certainly not about wars like this or about Wall Street, which is something that I've been focusing on. And that's why, Ted, I wanted you on this morning. I want to thank you for coming on and for what you've done, and to all the people who supported your going there to keep a sort of independent media presence alive. What is your blog? Can you just remind us about it so folks can check out what you're writing?
Sure. It's real simple. It's just rall.com, RALL.com, and then they can click on the blog and they'll see everything. In fact, I just put up a link to all the cartoons I filed from Afghanistan, so they can look at that in a kind of easy format.
Well, that's
Danny, we're going to have Ted back because he's written an incredible new book.
Okay, Ted, you're on, man.
About the collapsing vacuum of the United States.
Thank you.
You're on. I mean, I really enjoy your presence, your work, and you know, what little I can do to give it more visibility, I'm happy to try to do. And, you know, we need to find ways within the independent media movement to promote each other and support
Definitely.
Each other. This is something that's really been missing. You know, we get to be as competitive as the mainstream media, which is falling apart anyway. So that's not really a very effective model to turn to. The New York Times reports in its own business section today how its revenues are way down. So, I mean, this is, you know, we're living in an era of collapse and impending collapse. And, you know, at least we can try to keep our values and our spirits going and keep the work going. And so, Ted Rall, thank you very much for coming on today.
Thanks, Danny. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Well, we're going to switch ground a little bit because, as I mentioned to you before, I'm going to be out in Huntington, Long Island tonight. My God, I keep saying this week, but no, it's tonight, Thursday night, 7:30 at the Cinema Arts Center there. In Huntington, and it's apparently a very nice place. I haven't been there yet, but we hope to have a good discussion to show the film Plunder, and you are certainly invited. It's at 423 Park Avenue. One of the people who tells me he is coming is Eddie Morales. Eddie is a foreclosure expert. He works with Foreclosure Defense Group out of Hampstead, basically educating homeowners and working with attorneys to try to stop this wave of foreclosures. Welcome, Eddie.
Oh, thank you, Danny. It's a pleasure to be on the air with you. I appreciate the opportunity, and I'm looking forward, along with many other...
Okay, we have a little echo here, I think. I don't know. You're on a cell phone. Okay, no problem.
I apologize, yes. And we're looking forward to attending tonight. Yes, my offices are in Hempstead, New York, and we're currently working with many homeowners who, through our methods, are learning that it wasn't really their fault. They were basically came into these loans without knowing what they were buying into, and now we're uncovering, seeing that there was a lot of fraud. Banks are out there generating these false documents for the purpose of foreclosing. And we're working with some attorneys in New York, here in Long Island, especially one particular attorney, Keith Letterman, who's been doing a great job in representing these homeowners and helping them stop the foreclosures.
And you have been winning. I mean, this is the important thing. From what I understand, you have actually had judges stop foreclosures.
That is correct. What we've done is we've done the research, provided the documentation to the attorneys, the judges. The attorney has gone before the judge, presented this evidence, and the judges have seen and noticed basically that there's fraud going on, and with the evidence and the arguments that the attorneys have presented, it's very obvious that you know, the homeowners are being defrauded, and the judges are siding on the side of the homeowners, and they have been we're winning cases. As a matter of fact, one of the cases that Mr. Letterman won was featured on the Law Journal recently, cited on there. And as a matter of fact, as we speak, we're on the way to the court to stop a foreclosure action today for a property in Queens, New York.
So this is like so important because when people are confronted with foreclosure, and I, you know, interviewed many in my film Plunder, The Crime of Our Time, many of them not only didn't know what they were getting into when they signed onto the loan, but they don't know how to defend themselves to, you know, uphold their own rights. They tend to think, you know, it was their fault that they did something wrong, and now they're being foreclosed upon, and they don't realize that in some cases the people who are involved in these foreclosures are actually breaking the law themselves.
Yes, that's correct. As a matter of fact, that is exactly the case. What happens is, as officers of the court, the attorneys representing the banks, plaintiffs, are presenting documents, and because it's being presented to the court, to the judges, they basically assume that these institutions are not going to commit fraud and they're going to respect the law. And so that's one of the ways they get away with until we start looking deep into these documents, looking at what happened through, let's say, the securitization process, how it was one loan was supposed to go from A to B to C to D, and it needed to be properly assigned. They never recorded them. They circumvented the system, and now they're creating these documents solely for the purpose of foreclosing. So they have people who are signing affidavits who are not officers of the corporations they pretend to be. And as a matter of fact, that's the reason why GMAC this week, as a matter of fact, halted the foreclosure proceedings in 23 states because they know, they claim that there was a defect on the documents they presented to the court. I would say they know it's purposely done, it's fraud, and it is time now that the homeowners find a way, a solution. So Plunder, to me, is a great film because it helps open people's eyes and see, hey, this was purposely done. Learn as to what happened so you can know where you're standing and where you need to go.
See, this is really very meaningful to me. You know, as a filmmaker, you know, you do something, but when people who are actually involved in the trenches, in the fight for justice, economic justice, you know, think your work is valuable and are supportive of your work, that means a lot. You know, it means a lot to me, Eddie, you know, to have you supporting this project. I really think that the work you're doing is something that people should know about. We need foreclosure defense. We need to fight against these totally illegal thefts of people's property, their homes, their lives. I mean, it's devastating to a family to get thrown out of their home. You know, the father looks, you know, his kids, you know, basically blame him for doing something wrong. They have to move in with a relative or try to struggle to survive. Some become homeless. And it all is being done in, you know, there was an original crime in terms of these rip-off loans, and now there's a compounded crime with these shady foreclosures that are taking place. And then there are organizations, so-called foreclosure relief organizations, which are just scammers who are trying to actually steal the homes themselves. That's why the work you're doing really matters in my mind, okay?
Thank you.
And I want just to give people who are listening your phone number, so if they want to get in touch with the Foreclosure Defense Group, Eddie Morales, how do they do it?
They can call our office directly. The telephone number is area code 516-505-1004. Again, 516-505-1004.
You know, when I was talking to Eddie last night, you know, invited him to come on the show, you know, at the last moment over a bowl of vegetable paella. And, you know, he told me, he says, like, I don't really do media interviews, but he's very good at it. I think it's important, you know, that you speak out on this. We discovered, you know, back in the early 80s, when I worked at ABC News, I went as a producer to El Salvador to research the way the U.S. government was steering women into sterilization programs in El Salvador. And I was talking with Eddie about my work there in 1984. The story I did was later one of the few stories on 2020 that was actually suppressed. It was never allowed to be finished or to run. But nevertheless, what I discovered was the same year I was working on that, Eddie was fleeing El Salvador because of the terrible war and the death squads there. So, all right, Eddie, you sound busy. You sound like you've got to go. So, listen, I'll see you tonight, and anyone else who wants to come to the Cinema Arts Center, 423 Park Avenue, Huntington, New York. That's just 100 yards south of Route 25A in Huntington, Long Island, where we're going to be showing Plunder, the Crime of Our Time. Thank you, Eddie, for coming on.
Thank you, Danny. Thank you
very
much.
Okay, now we're moving on. Aaron Crown is back. We've been missing him for the past few weeks. Aaron is the editor of ML-implode.com and other related websites that have been monitoring this economic crisis. And I guess, you know, the two big stories of the week, you know, are the pronouncement by the National Bureau of Economic Research, you know, that the recession is over. You know, these people took a year to decide that we were in a recession, and then they decided just as mysteriously that we're no longer in a recession. I'd like to know what your take on that is, and also on the basic decision by Larry Summers to leave the White House, so as the chief economic advisor to the president. But let's start with this pronouncement about the recession.
They want you to think that that means the recession is over. But, you know, I saw some more wide-ranging data by the Consumer Metrics Institute, which puts out some really nice data, and they look at indicators which tell you, right, you know, concurrently whether you're likely to be in a recession. And it's pretty clear from their data, but they said basically, you know, yes, if we're going by the recession that started in 2008, it basically, you know, dipped above zero and formally ended, if you go by the NBER's metrics. But another one started in 2010. Basically, there was only a few months of non-recession, if you go by these silly metrics. And the current one we're in has already lasted 3 weeks longer than the one in 2008. So that's why it doesn't feel like we have any relief, because we're still in the same recessionary condition.
And not only that, but there are many people who are looking at the data, looking at what's actually happening, and they're worried, not, you know, about not just a recession, but a depression, you know, which some feel we're already in, and
right.
and an impending collapse.
Well, let's you know, characterize as depressions. If you look for the formal recessions, you're going to go in and out of recession, you know, as the economy flounders around. You know, we used to just characterize the whole period as a depression, and now that's taboo. You can't say that, but of course that's I think what you and I would both say it is.
So, you know, but yet, you know, what it seems to have done is signaled the media, you know, the mainstream media, the lamestream media, whatever you want to call it, you know, basically say, okay, over, let's move on, next story, please.
Right.
And, you know, just to assume, because one agency made one report, which they don't really understand the basis of, you know,
right,
to accept it as the final word on the subject. And this is what's so infuriating. And
yeah,
so,
well, and they're often too eager to just accept a plausible deniability that's offered by these broad brush headlines.
Yeah, you know, the stories that certainly I've been following, you know, I just can't get arrested on to talk about financial fraud and crime and the fact that there's been no prosecution of all these Wall Street big shots. You know, nobody wants to hear it. Nobody wants to discuss it. Now we have the Mr. Larry Summers going back to his $500,000 plus salary at Harvard. What's your take on this?
Well, he's one of many, you know, and they say rats will leave the sinking ship first. And I think there is a sense in the administration that that they had not fixed the economy. And many of us, you know, pundits out in the cold outside of the mainstream media have been suggesting that since they didn't do anything to fix fundamental problems, that was inevitable. And I think we're seeing some of that. You know, no one wants to be around for the ultimate reckoning. So, yeah, some people say it's just normal, you know, halfway point house cleaning. You know, I guess you can go with either interpretation you want. But, you know, you some statements by some people such as Christina Romer suggest that they know that the economy is still quite ailing.
You see, it seems like their big claim is not that they fixed the economy, but they avoided something worse.
Right.
That they're great, but of course nobody can see that, so it's hard to believe that, and there's no political payoff for that claim, essentially.
Right. Well, as long as people are unemployed and are ailing and living paycheck to paycheck, which the latest stats I saw, 77% of Americans are, they're not going to be relieved by these pronouncements.
Haven't we seen this movie before? I mean, George Bush Sr., you know, had just won the Gulf War. He was like this big hero. America's number one. And then he got his butt kicked in the election by Bill Clinton. I mean, it seems like, you know, we're in a situation here where the Obama people don't really seem to get what's going on and how serious it is. Aaron,
it's interesting you mentioned Obama. He had a town hall, I think it was put on by CNBC the other day. And, you know, from what he said, he's just expecting consumer spending to just start up again and have things take
off. Good luck to all of us. Anyway, thank you, Aaron, for coming on. Next time we'll get you on a little bit earlier. Thank you all for listening. News Dissector Radio moves to Mondays at 1 o'clock coming rather Fridays at 1 o'clock. Thank you, Matt, for correcting me from this time period as of next week. So please tune in then. We'll have the podcast up on my blog on mediachannel.org tonight or tomorrow. And please check in on that. Share this conversation with others if you like. Thank you for being here. I'm Danny Schechter, your news dissector, dissector at mediachannel.org.
Fantastic.